I meant to introduce that reading with just this simple hand motion that you've seen me use before. Many things are true at the same time. Does not mean that two things are always in opposition. That's oppositional thinking, in that we have to make an argument. I have this position, you take this position. Oppositional thinking. But it's more they're true at the same time. And we have to figure out how to hold them in that embrace, in that circle, in our mind, so that they become something new, not just remain two fists bumping into each other. Many things are true at the same time. Yesterday was the official opening of the National Museum of African American History and Culture. It was a project 100 years in the making, an embodiment of history affirming humanity. Tears welled up in me. It surprised me as President Obama finished his talk and walked over to the Bonner family to ring that 500-pound bell, which came from one of the first African-American congregations, and it was in Williamsburg, Pennsylvania, from, they said, the late 18th century. Our first African-American president, with a 99-year-old, it chokes me up, with the 99-year-old daughter of a slave and her 7-year-old great-granddaughter, pulled the rope several times. Other church bells in Washington joined in. John Lewis called the museum a testament to the dignity of the dispossessed and a statement of the worth and dignity of every human being. So what do we make of the auspicious timing of this proud museum and moment for and of America, the timing of it opening at the end of a week where again we watch videos of two African-American men being shot by police. Keith Scott in Charlotte and Terrence Crutcher in Tulsa, Oklahoma. The Unitarian Universalist Reverend Jay Leach was interviewed on CNN, and I just happened to catch it right as he was on the phone. And he called the video of Keith Scott being shot unbelievably heartbreaking. Unbelievably heartbreaking. And that it was. When I watched the new video last night that has been released, I have the sense, I can't do it. I don't know about you. I just can't do it. I have the feeling that I want to throw up. That's not a judgment. That's a physical reaction to somebody dying in front of me. Unbelievably heartbreaking. And that it was. Whether it turns out he had a gun or not, it is still unbelievably heartbreaking. We saw a protest that turned into a riot in Charlotte, and then we saw more nights of tense but mostly peaceful protests in Charlotte and then Atlanta. In his remarks, President Obama noted that even with all we have accomplished, justice is not colorblind. And he said that the history shared in the exhibits of the museum show us that protest and love of country don't just belong together, they inform each other. In a way, they are America. Many things are true at the same time. The National Museum of African American Culture and History is now a part of the Washington Mall, a part of our celebration of the history of our country. It sits there in its place near the Jefferson Memorial, the memorial that honors the author of the Declaration of Independence, all men are created equal, who was also a slave owner, and who also argued that without a history, you weren't fully human. So here we were at that moment of establishing history and humanity. Near the Lincoln Memorial, where Lincoln sits as the great emancipator. The Martin Luther King Memorial, honoring him as a leader of the civil rights movement, for the civil rights movement. There they are, all together, in the diversity and struggle that is the American story. This morning, we sit here. And in the last few months, I have come to see and feel and to realize, not with guilt or shame, but simply the clarity of helpful perspective, that the American prosperity and freedom that we, or maybe I should say that I am the beneficiary of and the participant in, has in its origins and its maintenance an ongoing history of human beings first being used and then being kept in their place, in quotes. Not ended, ongoing. I've heard it referred to as there are people who are disposable, at least to their place in society. Disposable in their civil rights. We know we have made progress as a country and as people in addressing these issues, and we celebrate that. But we are beginning to realize and articulate and experience that the energy that was put into those directions and ways of organizing society for so many years, while it may have lessened, it has not gone away. When slavery ended, it morphed into Jim Crow codes and oppressions. When the conditions of Jim Crow were dismantled, the energy that so passionately defended segregation and oppression did not just disappear. It took new forms. And one of those manifestations is in what is being called the new Jim Crow of mass incarceration. A subculture of those, again, without civil rights. Those who are not seen as deserving of the benefits of society. They became less than deserving because they broke the law. And so they are justifiably excluded. As I just went along with my life, I somehow didn't think that that was unfair. I didn't think about it much at all. But that's what happens if you break the law. You may disagree with me. You may misunderstand me. You may want to argue with me. That's fine. But I've come to see it a lot differently than I did. Again, it's an issue that has changed for me a lot like transgender rights did after the passing of HB 2. It is, as President Obama said in his remarks in opening the new National Museum, we must listen, we must hear, and most importantly, we must see. And for some reason that I don't get this year, I have begun to do that. And now I hear, I see, I care in ways that I didn't before. According to Department of Justice statistics, the U.S. prison population has risen from 500,000 in 1980. It was actually only 300 and some thousand in 1973, and there was talk about closing down the prisons because there really wasn't a need for them. That was a national study, by the way. It's risen from 500,000 in 1980 to 2.3 million today. Here's the big piece. With another 4.5 million people on probation or parole, that's 7 million people, mostly poor and black, who are excluded from most of the civil rights of America. And most of them are for nonviolent offenses and for drug convictions, the vast majority. Police enforce the laws, but enforcing is often selective. Consider this. Philando Castile, who was shot in July, had been stopped 31 times and charged with more than 60 minor violations, resulting in thousands of dollars in fines before his last fatal encounter with the police. Me, I drive through 7 stop signs to come to work and 8 going home. If you average that out, that's a total of 20,000 stop signs that I run during the course of the year. That's the potential for $1 million a year if they caught me with every stop sign I ran and charged me $50 a stop sign. But actually, they charge $150 into the system, so I am worth $3 million per year if I were stopped at every stop sign I roll through. How many stop signs have I been stopped for rolling through during the 19 years I've lived in Hendersonville, North Carolina? How many? One. I've been to driving school once. Consider this. Alton Sterling was arrested because he was hustling, selling CDs to get by. He was unable to work in the legal economy due to his felony record. His act of survival was treated by the police as a major crime, apparently punishable by death. That's a quote from Michelle Alexander. And we hand police the job of containing this subculture of 7 million people that we have created. Many things are true at the same time. And so here we sit, experiencing the tragedy and heartbreak and seeing and hearing everyone's frustrations with the untenable mess that we have created for ourselves and find ourselves in. Something more is required. The title for today is from a blog piece written by Michelle Alexander, who's a civil rights lawyer and advocate and author of the book, The New Jim Crow. And she says, and mother. Here are her words written in July, and they are even more pertinent today. I have struggled, she says, to find words to express what I thought and felt as I watched the videos of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile being killed by the police. Thursday night, I wanted to say something that hasn't been said 100 times before. It finally dawned on me that there is nothing to say that hasn't been said before. As I was preparing to write about the oldness of all of this and share some wisdom passed down from struggles of earlier eras, I heard on the news that 11 officers had been shot in Dallas, several killed from sniper fire. My fingers froze on the keys. I could not bring myself to recycle old truths. Something more is required. But what? I think we all know deep down that something more is required of us now. This truth is difficult to face because it's inconvenient. It's inconvenient and deeply unsettling. I hadn't heard how powerful a phrase that and how meaningful it is to our lives until right now. It's inconvenient. And deeply unsettling. And yet silence isn't an option. On any given day, there's always something I'd rather be doing than facing the ugly racist underbelly of America. And I know that I am not alone. But I also know that the families of the slain officers and the families of all those who have been killed by the police would rather not be attending funerals. And I'm sure that many who refused to ride segregated buses in Montgomery after Rosa Parks stood her ground wish they could have taken the bus rather than walk miles in protest day after day for a whole year. But they knew they had to walk. If change was ever going to come, they were going to have to walk. And so do we. If change is ever going to come, what it means to walk today will be different for different people, will be different for different people and different groups and in different places. I'm asking myself what I need to do in the months and years to come to walk my walk with greater courage. It's a question that requires some time and reflection, not just reaction. I hope it's a question we are all asking ourselves. Truly transformative change depends more on thoughtful creation of new ways of being than reflexive reaction to the old ways. One of the advantages and effects of reading things on the computer and the ability to compose them there is you can put very moving pictures next to these words. And just below these words in her blog post is a picture of a young African-American boy, probably 5, 6 years old. So he's got cuteness that just won't stop in his big eyes. And he has on a hat that's a winter hat, the ones that are way too big and the earmuffs come down and you fold it up in the front. And he's standing there holding a sign under his face and just looking with that openness, that sense of Yeah. It says, stop the violence. It's written in multicolors. It says, stop the violence. Pray for our future. The key word here in this reading is courage. Courage. Not as bravery in the face of danger, but as courage as a word of the heart, as in having an open heart in the face of our resistance and defensiveness and argument. An open heart. The other word is creation. New ways that we make out of our very being. New ways that are created, that come from the heart and not outside of us. We don't wait for them, but they're created within us because we are open and concerned. It's your heart. Friday was the 1 year anniversary, Friday morning, of my heart surgery. And I've come to think of heart very differently in the year since. Created within us because we are opened and concerned. It's your heart. Open and concerned so you will walk the walk with greater courage. Walk the walk for us means take the time, the inconvenience. Walk the walk means take the time. When somebody asks you to put your body on the line, the way you interpret it is, how do I take the time to put my body in a different place than what is convenient? And you will only take the time from the many other things of your life if you care, because you care, because you are moved. I listen, I see, I care. That is the path to transformative change. On any given day, there's always something I'd rather be doing than facing the ugly racist underbelly of America. I know that I am not alone. And yet it can be done. We will do it. We are facing it. We have taken some first steps with courage. We have seen our perspectives change and our hearts open. In 2 hours, we began to listen, to hear, to see, and to care more. There were over 40 of us who attended the workshop that Reverend Michael Carter led, Reverend Judy Long helped with, and I helped a little bit with, on the subject of race. I can tell you that when we entered that room, the energy was a little edgy. It was uncertain. There were words like, I'm not racist. There was sharing of past history of, I was in the civil rights movement. It's a need to tell story, but it's also that sense of, I've done my work. I was in the civil rights movement. My brother-in-law is African-American. You know, and you can list the different things that I am. But during the course of that evening, we went and Michael led us through this, and it was brilliant. We actually worked to an institutional understanding or definition of racism as privilege plus power. Or prejudice, really prejudice, because the privilege is in the power. Prejudice plus power equals racism. And it was, we even went worked through that in that definition, if you don't have the power, you can't be racist. You can have racial prejudice. I can see some of you go like this. You can have racial prejudice, but you can see there's that reaction. We all had that reaction. We worked through in that space of 2 hours to sort of open hearts. We talked about white privilege. Is that privilege that I have in the world just because I am white and it's made for me? I described a little bit of it and how I get to run stop signs for forever and nobody cares. Trivial example. And we got to move from reacting to that to not feeling guilty, to not feeling bad about myself, to moving into that space. And why did that happen? It surprised me. It happened because we were sitting there with the atmosphere of family. And we didn't know it, setting it up. But Michael was there. Michael and Judy were there. Kevin was there in another room doing her homework. And they're having to go interact with her. We all knew each other in some way or not. And even if you're a little bit a stranger to the group, you could feel that energy. Open hearts, open more courage. Something more is required. That means that the work is not done. Not only is it not done, it needs my attention, it needs your attention. It is not going to change unless you pay it attention. It's not enough anymore to rest on my good liberal credentials of what I did when I was in high school and they segregated it, or how I was in my community. It's not enough anymore to rest on my good liberal credentials as if something has been completed and I can retire. It's not enough to look for appreciation and think that I deserve it. And what I did then is enough now. It's not enough anymore to retreat into the righteousness of law and order, to think simply that they break the law and I don't, so their otherness now is somehow justified. It's time to look at the laws and the way they are enforced and to the attitudes and fears of those who we require to be our enforcers and to protest for changes. It's not enough that my intentions are good. As I talk to people to find out where to go in my search for some understanding, a book by Ta-Nehisi Coates was recommended as required reading. It's called Between the World and Me. Have many of you read it? I recommend it to you. It's very short. It's written as a letter to his adolescent son. He pivots from the biggest questions of American history and ideals to the most intimate concerns of a father for his son and for his son's survival in the world. To his son, he writes, "This is your country, this is your world, this is your body, and you must find some way to live within all of it." And he says about good intentions are a hall pass through history. He admonishes his son to engage the struggle, knowing that triumphs or success are not guaranteed. They may not even be the point. Quote, "Perhaps struggle is all we have because the God of history," he says, "is an atheist, and nothing about his world is meant to be." It can be, it can become, but it is not meant to be. Struggle does not assure victory, quote, "but or only an honorable and a sane life." This is what and why we should engage. It's what should engage us in the struggle. It's why we should engage for a selfish reason. An honorable and a sane life in the real and the particulars of life and joy and love, so that struggle is not a word of sacrifice or loss or inconvenience, but a word of life. Life lived real and well and fully from the heart and with courage. As the National Museum of African American History and Culture showed yesterday, the history of America is powerful and has endured and transformed and become much. And as the events of the last few years and of just the last few weeks have made clear too, nothing is done. And there are ways we need to go. New history begins when? Today. New history begins today. And it begins today where? With each of us. How? As we create it, as we bring it into being. There is no hall pass or diploma for the wall. After Ruth Bonner and her great-granddaughter and Michelle Obama rang the bell, and then President Obama high-fived the great-grandson, who was even younger. He was like 4 or 5. They went into the museum, and the camera moved inside. As the door opened, they moved inside, and they walked through. I think the events of this summer and this week have opened the door into our hearts. They've opened the door into our caring. And now is the moment where we decide if we are going to open that door some more and step through, or are we going to close it and go back. So I say, let us open our hearts. Let us step through with commitment and walk in. Let us walk the walk with courage. Something more is required. The bell is ringing for a new day. In you, in us, and in America.